Rock's lecture given at the Old Cheese Factory on the 30th of June 1994. The lecture's about the history of the cheese factory from 1854 to 1904.
Excuse me, everybody. Bob Barker sends his apologies. He regrets he can't be here tonight. And in his absence, it's my pleasure as historical officer of the City of Berwick to introduce our speaker for this evening. This is Cameron Rock, who's been doing a project on the Job Skills Project with the City of Berwick. And for the last 4 months, he's been working on the history of the cheese factory. And tonight he's going to talk to us about the history from about, I think it's 1854 to about 1904. He's come up with a lot of fascinating information, so I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you very much, Julie. Thank you, everyone, and a big thank you for all attending tonight. The City of Berwick set me the task of researching the history of the Springfield property from 1854 to 1900. These dates represent the period of history when the Clark members of the Clark family owned the property. It's during this period in history that the old cheese factory was built and operated. And the first task I was given was to collate the historical information already collected on the property. When all these facts were collated, some of them didn't, or not all of them agreed with each other, and there was also some hints that there was quite an interesting story behind the creation of the old cheese factory. I've been researching this topic for about the past 4 months, and I've solved some of the mysteries behind the cheese factory, and there's a couple of little ones that still remain a bit unsolved. My discoveries are the content of my lecture tonight, and there will be a brief question time, a period for questions after the end of the lecture. Okay, our story begins in Berwick, 1854. Have the lights killed, please, Rich. Sort of focus there. In 1854, this is when the land south of Berwick was subdivided into crown allotments, and it was subsequently sold to private interests. A land tycoon by the name of William John Turner Clark, later known as Big Clark, snapped up allotments 25 and 26, which are here, and allotments 35 through to 38 here. This chunk of property is about 5 square miles in area. And the earliest known name of this entity, and I call it an entity because it's a survey of the size of Berwick, you can see it's quite, that's the original size of Berwick, it's quite a huge area of land. The first name given to it was Spring Station, and that was discovered in 1880. And the section in yellow there is the site of the old cheese factory, where our historical property is today, and that's Homestead Road. And this property stayed intact up till 1900. Okay, about the purchaser, William John Turner Clark. He was quite a tall man. He was born on 20th of April 1805 in Somerset in England. He was born with a congenital hip disorder and also had a consumptive disposition. He was, as a child, he showed aptitude in mathematics, particularly arithmetic, and he could add up with, and he didn't need a slate to do this. That was as a child. His physical impairment didn't stop him from becoming a good horseman, and that made him well suited to droving, which was his first job. And he was paid quite a good wage for doing that. Throughout his droving, he was exposed to the livestock markets, and soon became a player once he built up a bit of savings. He applied his arithmetic skills and rapidly accumulated savings of £2,000 through prudent buying and selling of livestock. He was still ailed by consumption though as a young adult and decided to migrate to Van Diemen's Land, or Tasmania as we know it now. And that was a climate that was better, and a lot of people healed themselves of consumption by moving out to Tasmania or to Australia. His £2,000 capital that he had automatically gave him was entitled to a land grant of 2,000 acres. He later called this the Windfalls property. He eloped to Australia with Eliza Dowling and left in 1829. He took his own livestock with him, and that was in the hull of a sailing ship on the high seas. And over a 4-month voyage, he didn't lose one head of stock, which is quite incredible. Got to think about the stock had to be fed, watered, sanitised, and they were constantly wounded by the rocking of the ship, and you know, wounds had to be disinfected, etc. Quite remarkable. And on moving to Van Diemen's Land, he overcame his consumption and he started to build up his sheep herds. His breed was Leicester sheep that he chose, and they turned out to be both good for wool and for meat, which was the quality that Merino sheep, well, they were only good for their wool. He had sufficient livestock in Van Diemen's Land to send up to the Port Phillip district when it was opened up. And Port Phillip district is what we know today as Victoria, and it was part of New South Wales at that time. And he was one of the instigators in requesting that it be opened up for grazing. He sent up exactly 1,958 sheep to the Port Phillip district in 3 consignments, and departed them at Station Peak, which is near the Yuyangs. And that was in 1837, and he employed a manager to look after his properties and remained living in Tasmania. Next slide. Okay, this is an old squatter's map of Victoria. It's in dated 1850, but it shows some of the old counties. Mornington was this county here, which is our whole area. Another interesting one was Bourke, which is that area of the northern parts of Melbourne, Port Phillip Bay being there. So the first property was near the Yuyangs. When his sheep herd started to grow, he needed more pastures, and he moved out to around the Ballarat area. And there was an open grassland, but it was also a forest, and he named it Dowling Forest after Eliza. And when his livestock grew, they kept on doubling in size every few years, he moved out to around the Horsham area to a property called Woodlands. By 1850, his herds had grown to somewhere between 80 and 100,000 sheep. And it had an annual wool clip of £20,000. And with the proceeds of this, he purchased his leased runs when they became available for sale, and these were thousands of acres in size. Concurrently in Tasmania, he had 3 children with Eliza. There was William, born in 1831, Thomas in 1832, and Joseph in 1834. He also had a daughter with Eliza's sister Jane. That affair sort of soured their marriage, and Eliza demanded that the pregnant Jane be sent home to be housed in England, and that was to avoid public scandal. And the husband had to pick up the tab, not only for sending her back, but to house her in England. But by that time, Big Clark had established wealth. Eliza herself returned to England in 1847 and took the children with her. But one of the reasons was to give them a better education. They all returned later, but the oldest son, William, returned in 1851, and that was to work with his father. Okay, during the 1850s, Big Clark was involved in, every bit of land parcel that became available, he was just snapping them up left, right and centre. So 1854, he purchased the little Berwick, 5 square miles at Berwick. But he also started to get into some grander land grabs and public scandals, and all of these were financed by his ever-growing wealth. The first land grab, or the first coup, was in 1850. Clark grabbed an unsurveyed 31,000 acres in the Sunbury area. Basically, 10 years earlier, he'd been given a letter saying that if he could find an area 20,000 acres in size, unsurveyed, he could purchase it at £1 an acre, which was an absolute bargain price by that time. So what did Big Clark do? He had a look and found there was a 30,000 acres, very well settled area in Sunbury, and he put in the request, and it was made under widespread protest in the community, but by law it had to be granted to him at that price. However, this land grab was seen as a salvation by the tenants, because the 1850-51 drought that year, the livestock in that area completely stripped the vegetation and were dying. He purchased all the tenants' stock at a fair price, and he had his bigger pastures out to graze them in. And if he hadn't have done that, the livestock would have died and the tenants would have been left with absolutely nothing. Other things Big Clark was involved in, he floated the Belinda Gold Mining Company. He allotted shares equivalent to the value of the real estate. This was in around the Sunbury area. There was no gold found on the property, which was contrary to the promise in the prospectus. And when the company failed, he legally retained possession of the land. He tried unsuccessfully to purchase Phillip Island, but was beaten on the point of law. He also bailed out the New Zealand government. They'd run themselves into debt and were just about to go bankrupt, but for this honour he relieved them of ownership of about 80,000 acres of prime grazing land that was leased under the Crown. Huge protest in New Zealand, as you can imagine, when that scandal came to light. And in 1864 he ventured into East Gippsland. Got a little thing saying unsurveyed country there. He got into cattle in this area and bought a total of about 80, or he leased a total of about 83,000 acres in Gippsland. He also purchased, that was in 1864, he purchased holding paddocks at Terrelgan and Yawn around this area. And he also used the Berwick property as a holding paddock, and he had another 5,000 acres at Mornington. That string of properties meant that the cattle didn't lose condition when they drove to Melbourne. Okay, so there's a chain of properties there. Okay, just in a brief summary of Big Clark up to now, he was never ever found to be late in paying debt. He would sometimes borrow money at higher rates of interest to pay it down on time. He's perfect reputation in that respect. He was capable of dealing with the Aborigines personally on all his far out grazing runs. He wasn't afraid of them and negotiated with them. And his grazing was pretty undestructive. He just grazed on natural pastures. He had quite a bit of luck. That was particularly with the shipping of his livestock from Van Diemen's Land to Port Phillip District. Just about everyone else that tried this lost one ship. There was many, many shipwrecks. And on one occasion, Big Clark missed a boat by 5 minutes that was heading to Port Phillip, and that sunk, and everyone on board was drowned. He made profits in droughts by investing in a process called boiling down, where they'd throw sheep in this big tank of boiling water and skim off the fat to make tallow. And he also understood economic cycles. He had huge cash reserves and bought all, when everyone else went bust, he bought all their property at really cheap prices. Okay, the first use that he had for the Spring Station property was purely a money-making exercise. The government sold land in outlying areas at very, very low prices. This landlord was snapped up by huge. This land was snapped up by huge landholders. 5 square miles to Big Clark. When settlement followed later, they released this land for sale at just little selected bits at a time, and they kept the land scarce to people, and they were able to sell it on the open market at about double the price they paid for it. And this turnover could have been just even a few years after they purchased it. This is a title search of the Crown Portion 26 in the parish of Berwick, which is the section the cheese factory is on. 633 acres in that section, purchased at £950, that's about £1.5 per acre. Leased to Charles Forrester and Henry Monteith for 7 years. They had to put up security of a property at the corner of William and Little Lonsdale Street, and they had the option to purchase in 7 years at £3.10 per acre, double the price that Big Clark paid for it. And next slide, please. Well, Henry and Monteith left the property after the 7 years and chose not to take up the purchasing option. The next tenant that came to the property was Robert Henry in 1863. There was no official lease agreement on the title search. He moved to Spring Station from Ballarat, and that's where Clark Stowling Forest Run was, so he would have found out of the vacancy here at Berwick through that. But he was no stranger to the Berwick area. He was previous to Ballarat, he was on the Gingin Bean Run at Officer. In 1851, at the height of the drought I was talking about earlier, there was a huge fire that burnt out virtually the whole central part of Victoria from the coast up to the border. It was called Black Thursday. When the fire swept through the Gingin Bean Run, Henry's family were lucky to escape. They sheltered in a very deep waterhole that naturally occurred on the Cadinia Creek at that time. Robert Henry's hut was also survived the fire too. And Henry himself on that day was at the Remembering Races, which is at the current site of the Prince of Mark Hotel, and that race meeting was broken up when the fire just completely engulfed it. Dying animals out in the Sunbury area weren't affected by the fire because, as I said before, they'd stripped the vegetation. On Spring Station, Henry established a herd of shorthorn cattle. The pleura pneumonia, a dreaded disease, was discovered in a few of the cattle, and it was also highly contagious. Government inspectors were called out to verify that it was pleura pneumonia, and they ordered that the whole herd had to be destroyed. It was quite a substantial herd. All the men from the Berwick area were gathered up to do this pretty hideous task. The cattle were dragged by Henry's bullet team. By the way, this is a photograph early this century of the Springs property, or the Spring Station property. You can see that how it was thick tea tree, and this is a clearing operation going on here, but this is a view of pretty much what it would have looked like back in those pioneer times. A bullet team was used to drag all the slaughtered animals onto a big fire to burn them all, and after the bullocks did that job, they were ordered to be destroyed as well, and then thrown on the fire. The harnesses were thrown on, all the harnesses of the bullock team was thrown on, and Robert Henry himself didn't even return home with a shirt on his back, and they all had to throw their clothes into the fire as well. Soon after this, Robert Henry left the property. Jeff Spencer, who resides on a part of the original Spring Station, is with us tonight. He stated that he's found a whole lot of small pieces of cattle harness near the corner of Breeds and Pound Road, which is most probably the site, we think, of where this big fire was made. It's also a pretty central part of the property, which is another logical reason for it being there. And the next tenants to come on in 1866 were the MacDonald brothers, and they leased the property for an annual rent of £300 per annum. Next slide, please. This is a copy of the immigration papers of the MacDonald brothers. They came to Australia from Scotland on the ship the Marmot Shah. Can we try a bit of focus there, please, Steve? That's better. Oh, hang on, it was nearly there. That's it. Okay. I'll just read it out for you, though. We had Flora MacDonald, the mother of the children here, age 57, housekeeper. Malcolm, who was a labourer, age 33. John, a shepherd, age 25. Anne, a dairymaid, age 21. And Murdoch. He was also a shepherd, age 16. Okay. And like Robert Henry, the MacDonald brothers moved to Spring Station from Ballarat. Okay, we were able to trace where the MacDonald brothers first went to when they were in Australia. Next slide, please. Okay, this is there was a whole host of civil registrations which give a pretty clear picture. We had all three brothers married in Ballarat. We have a timeline down this side from 1855 down to 1870. Las Vegas, yeah, that's right. Okay, we had, in 1855, Malcolm married Margaret MacDonald. There were so many MacDonalds at that time, it wasn't a relative. Murdoch married Elizabeth Tulloch, and later John married Margaret McIver in 1865. The sections in yellow are the births of their children and where they were born, and it gives a pretty consistent pattern of where they were living. We had Flora in 1856, Flora in Ballarat, Isabella in 1857. We had, in 1858, we had Norman Kenneth in Lexton, 1859, Flora Ann in Lexton Springs. And in 1861, we had Alexander born in Learmonth, Margaret born in Learmonth. 1862, John born in Springs, Elizabeth born at Springs, which was a suburb of Ballarat, or just out of Ballarat. 1864, Kenneth was born in Learmonth. And as we move down, voila, 1866, David Alexander born in Berwick. And Murdoch and Elizabeth's final child was Anne, born in 1870. Next slide, please. So I just did a little bit of a map showing you where their movements were. You know what? Having trouble getting focus. There we go. Yeah. Right, we've got Ballarat. First they moved up to Lexton, back down to Learmonth, to Springs, which was near Ballarat, and then back to Learmonth, and then the next record is in Berwick. That's all. Big Clark's Dowling Forest Run was around there at that time, so they would have become aware of the vacancy as well, from being in Big Clark country, basically. So the next use of the... So with the MacDonald brothers, the Spring Station had a dual purpose. It was a holding paddock for Big Clark's some Gippsland cattle, and he also used to go out there, he used to ride down in his horse and carriage a couple of times to visit the property, probably to inspect the incoming livestock from Gippsland. And at the same time, the MacDonalds were leasing the property for £300 per annum. When it came to managing the tenants though, it was Big Clark's eldest son, William, who was a key figure. Okay, next slide, please. Here we have a picture of Big Clark's son, William. Okay. When William returned to Australia in 1850, his first task he was given to was to manage the outpost properties in the Western District. William was a young man, he was quite shy, and he was entirely unsuited to disciplining the tough ex-convicts that Big Clark employed on these properties. On one boat ride from Van Diemen's Land to Port Phillip, Big Clark boasted to another passenger how well staffed these properties were, i.e. tough men for a tough place. There was a few squabbles with Aborigines at the time, resulting in a few deaths. It was hard to judge what impression Big Clark had on this gentleman though, because this gentleman was travelling to Melbourne for an anti-transportation rally. Big Clark wasn't aware of that. But after William's failings in the Western District, he was requested that he be sent to Tasmania to manage the established Clark properties down there. One particular property, Norton Mandeville, had a gentleman's residence in which he resided. In 1860, William married Mary Walker and moved back to Victoria. They had three children, a son and two daughters, but unfortunately Mary died in 1871. On returning to Victoria, he started working in his father's Pacific Chambers office, which is the corner of William Street and Collins Street. And this was with the head clerk, I can't say head clerk, head clerk, of John Mundy. Head clerk John Mundy for Big Clark. That was his main office where all his properties were managed. William managed this sundry special survey, but also other properties as well. It was at this time that William became aware that he was going to inherit his father's Victorian properties, which were quite substantial. William had different ideas, though, on the best way of utilising the family fortune when that day arrived. He had a belief in upgrading the estates getting your tenants to adopt the latest scientific farming techniques in a sustainable manner. To do this, the tenants would have to be capitalised with the latest equipment and knowledge, and in return they'd have to sign long lease agreements to cover the costs. But in the long term it would provide a good return, and what tenant would refuse getting a hold of new equipment and the best knowledge on how to farm? Upgrading properties, he also defined as lifting their value by erecting first-class buildings. To his father, Big Clark, a name attributed to his large property holdings as much as his physique, to him buildings were tying up capital that it could be used on buying more land. He had a bit of a contempt for them. As a manager of tenants, William had the power to run some of the minor properties as he wished, because his father was preoccupied with his bigger things like the Belinda gold mining and all, Phillip Island, etc. Spring Station is a clear example of this. Not long after the McDonald brothers moved up to the property here, the first class dwelling was erected, which is the present day Springfield homestead. There's no records of the construction, but we've had an eminent architect, Darren probably liked that description, but an architect from the Historic Buildings Council that found some architectural features that date it as the late 1860s. Okay, can we have next slide, please? The fireplace is consistent with the time. Next one. The plaster mouldings and the rose on the roof. Next slide. The stained glass windows and the arch in the hallway, and just the fact that it was plastered. That was plastered, only become commercially available in the late 1860s. And final slide, we have the bricklaying pattern. It's a solid brick house. You can see one brick laid lengthways, the next one turned in. So not lengthways turned in, lengthways turned in. That pattern was consistent with that period as well. Okay. Another clue that suggests that William was actually managing the Spring property was that the McDonald brothers at this time were mounting a large debt, and that was presumably with no security. And that was totally contrary to the way Big Clark did business. Even for leaseholds, he always made sure there was security to cover the payments of the lease. But the household built there was just part of a far bigger plan. Cheese making, a segment of agriculture, shrouded by mystery until the 1850s, was the subject of much scientific research. And as a result of this search, a process of cheese making was about to revolutionise cheese making throughout the world. And this occurred in the 1870s. Naturally, William, interested in scientific farming, wanted to play a leading role in this recent development, and he decided that Spring Station was a place where this was going to occur. It was in 1870 when Big Clark's state of health was starting to show signs that he was nearing the end of his life. He had a stroke and became paralysed, but tenaciously hung on to life up till 1874, when he died on the 13th of January. The funeral was largely attended, but some of the press couldn't resist having a stab at him. A quote from the Daily Telegraph: "His widespread reputation was not a result of a career of public usefulness, but consequent upon his wealth." Okay, next slide, please. This is a monument erected to Big Clark, and this was commissioned by his son William. That's in Melbourne Cemetery. Just excuse us for a moment.